This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This month on Cadenza, we're featuring a wide variety of talented pianists, and this week we'll speak with the fascinating American artist Bruce Levingston. One of this country's leading figures in contemporary classical music, his award-winning and critically acclaimed recordings are exemplary in their creative programming and pairing of piano works across the centuries. You're listening to the opening track of his CD titled Still Sound, music of the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt, his Für Alina. But also on this disc is music of Chopin, Schubert, Erik Satie, William Bolcom, and composer, visual artist, and highly respected psychologist Dr. Augusta Gross. My guest has collaborated with top artists in music, but also visual arts, the stage, film, and dance. He is passionate about commissioning new works for his instrument through his foundation Premier Commission, and also about the importance and impact music can have on social issues of our day, such as human rights and education. Born in the deep south of Mississippi, he now embraces his home state, splitting his time between there and New York City, which is where I caught up with him during a photo shoot.
I am here today with pianist Bruce Levingston. Good to meet you, by the way.
Hey, nice to meet you, too.
I'm not alone in this, but when I got the first recording I got of you on Sonoluminous, and I looked and I thought, this is pretty interesting programming for a CD. And then the next one, and then the next one. And people started to realize that you're an artist who's someone who has a real gift. You don't want to put out just another run-of-the-mill CD, another there's 150 of these already out on the market type of CD.
Sure.
So two things to start here. There's a gift to programming. There's a little insight into programming, whether a disc or a recital.
Right.
So give us a little bit of that, and then maybe the process of how you bring pieces in, eliminate them, add them, and create.
Sure. You know, when I put a CD or a concert program together, first of all, I'm trying to think about how I would like to hear the music myself. I'd like to think of myself first as the listener, as somebody that's taking a journey. And what would it be like? What's the very first thing that you hear? It's so important, as I've gone to so many recitals, and the very first note tells everything. You know?
Yeah.
So I think sometimes for years about the opening of a particular program, will it do justice to the journey? Will it say the right thing? And that opening, if it's going to lead to a Beethoven sonata or something of Schubert or Bach, and I almost never start just with Bach because
right.
I would so, it's such great music that I want to lead people to this place. And so things like that, the structure of an opening and ending, what is the body? You know, Rachmaninoff used to talk about something called the point in a piece, and he would be frustrated. He would say, oh, I missed the point, meaning that for him, the point could be in the middle, it could be at the end, it could be loud or soft, but somehow everything goes around it, and if that's moved in the wrong place or you miss it when you come upon it, all the architecture, the experience falls apart.
House of Cards falls apart.
Exactly. And so I think of these programs a little bit that they have some place or point, but the point might not even be the music, it might be the silence between pieces that is this dramatic moment.
What's interesting, the Bach comment, because a number of people think, if I play Bach, I can go anywhere from Bach. And you just reversed it, saying, no, I have to go to Bach.
I very much love that. Yeah.
But go through the process. Do they need a theme? Do they need a journey, which means we start here and here? Do you sometimes just do tapestries? I mean, there's an art to programming. There's this piece, no.
I don't like over... themey programs, actually, for somebody that thinks about
theme is a new word, but
okay. I just mean that sometimes we'll see something that, okay, it's a set of variations, so you may have some Beethoven variations and some Haydn variations and some Tchaikovsky variations. Okay, well, this is interesting, really. And yes, there's a form, there's a sonata form, but I try to find the spiritual connection between the pieces, and those connections may not be obvious. I often have people tell me that when they open the program at a concert, they look at it and think, how is this going to work? This cannot possibly hold together,
right.
This cannot work.
Right.
And then when they hear the pieces, somehow it makes sense. So that, I've had Arvo Pärt on a program with Bach or with Schubert, or because there's some connection there, or the right piece of Domenico Scarlatti. Scarlatti is a very deep composer, you know?
Yeah.
It's not all just the fast repeated notes. And so that you can find all kinds of emotion in each of these great composers. So sometimes it's the piece or the side of the composer that I'm trying to bring out, or sometimes a spiritual statement that they may be making. So when I think of certain things that I've done, leaning towards what these composers have that's a universal commonality, and sometimes it's with each other, sometimes it's humanity. And I think the Carnegie Hall program that I will do in the coming season, I'm finding pieces that make a statement about why we have a right to be where we are. So many composers have commented on what it means to be a citizen,
mm-hmm.
a citizen or a hope to be a citizen or a hope for freedom. And so I've chosen works and composers that comment on that.
Is this difficult for you, or are you one of these people who just have lists and lists of programs that you're itching to do? You just need to find this piece or that piece.
I don't think of programs first. I think of the music.
Think of the music first.
Absolutely. It just happens to be that what I'm playing or the events of my life. And sometimes it's a major piece that then dictates everything else.
From his recording of 2015, cited by the New York Times as one of the best of the year, called Heavy Sleep, Here is the 90-plus-year-old Hungarian composer Györgyi Kurtág's transcription of Johann Sebastian Bach's chorale setting of Gottes Zeit ist die allerbeste Zeit, BWV 106, performed by my guest today, Bruce Lovingston.
It's been more of a trend with younger artists, especially ensembles, one thinks of like string quartets, of taking a composer, a work from the pantheon, the great pantheon of composers,
right.
Name whoever they are, Beethoven, Schubert, Bach,
yes.
And Brahms, and then putting a new piece side by side, and you sort of just alluded to this when you were talking before, of juxtaposing those pieces. And many of these young ensembles don't think anything of it, but pianists seem, my opinion, but I've interviewed a lot of them, a little bit slower to try to do that, whereas whether a recording or recital, new music, let's say it's a recording, new music would be a disc of all new music, or it would be in a theme disc of Brazilian piano music.
Right.
Or if it's a Schubert disc, still 9 times out of 10, it's all Schubert.
For sure.
But you are not that way. I mean, give the mindset of a pianist who's a little bit slower to say, boy, that's kind of a sacred ground that I don't want to jam on.
You know, I've been doing this for so long, even when I was quite young, commissioning, or people were writing for me and would send me things. And eventually I started a music foundation called Premier Commission.
Right.
And sure. And with that, it was just a way to kind of organize. I was already kind of paying out of my own pocket for these pieces. So I thought, okay, let me get some organization about this. And I had some wonderful help to do it. I've always been passionate about what is being written in my own lifetime.
Right.
And so it's not that I always necessarily like everything I hear, but I'm interested. What is happening? Who's painting what now? Who's writing what? You know, when Picasso was painting, Eric Satie was writing, and Ravel was alive, and Debussy, and Diaghilev, and the Ballet Russe. And there were these great periods like that. And I felt that I was living in a period with many great artists from different mediums that had worked together and thought of things together. And so it just led me to start thinking about that as I commissioned works. But mostly when I would get a work, and particularly if I got a great work, and most of the time the composers, I've been very fortunate, have written really beautiful, substantial works, then I would think, I'm not going to play this like, okay, let's get the new piece of music out of the way so we didn't. This, I mean, I didn't even feel that, so I certainly wouldn't have done it. But it, rather, I would really try to put that as the centerpiece of the program,
right,
and make a major statement. This is what this composer at this moment in time has to say about something. And then where does this composer come from? Who's influenced the composer? Sometimes I'll ask, but who is inside of you that you heard, that influenced you, guided you? And sometimes then that will lead me to think about, okay, maybe this composer loves Messiaen or Debussy, or maybe it's Beethoven. And can then I find something, a great connection there, and put it on the program. And then from that, that might lead me, as I, if I play a piece of Beethoven or Schumann, who was influencing Schumann? Of course, it's Bach.
Yeah.
And it, so much comes back to the well of something like Bach. Or
do you inform the composers, or are the composers interested of who surrounds them, whether it's be a recital or, in the case of more something that lasts, a recording? Do they care who they are sidling up against?
Most composers that I've played and come to know are very interested in the neighborhood. And it reminds me that, I think this was in Gary Graffman's book, but somebody, I believe he played at Carnegie Hall, a program, and included Stravinsky's Serenade en La, and then some Rachmaninoff pieces. And I believe that it could be another composer, but I believe this is right. And then somebody found the program that Stravinsky was holding, and I think he'd scribbled, "What a Neighborhood." And so there you go. You get, you know, maybe not all composers like the people they're with, but most are interested. They want to be, look, I think they want to be considered part of the pantheon of people contributing in history to our art. And so, sure, they're interested. And I also think then they're interested in the person they're writing for. You know, Brahms and Mozart were very much listening to certain instrumentalists or singers. And I think those artists' gifts or qualities were then influencing what they would do. And I think to some degree that's also happened with me, that people hear me play something and again they'll say, "Oh, I liked what you did here, or how you colored something here or shaded something, and I'm going to write something that allows you to do those things."
You mentioned it, so give a little more background on the Premier Commission. I mean, how does it work?
So it's a classic 501c3. And when I started thinking about this, I turned to a great friend, David Rockefeller, who recently died at 101. And I was asking him a little bit about structures for things. And he said, "Well, you know, my family knows something about foundations and we can help you." And he arranged for me to meet his lawyer, the family lawyer that had worked on so many of their foundations. And while David was a great friend, it wasn't that he wrote a big check. Rather, he matched what I did. So I put in and he put in. Okay. And it was just a little bit at a time all the way through. But the fact that he would be supportive also, of course, helped draw other support. And it was the patron, I think, at its best. And his best.
It's still continuing, even though.
And the Premier Commission, of course, continues. I mean, it wasn't relying on any one person. We do benefits and fundraisers, and then what it allows is I can be, I mean, it's not a great big foundation or anything, but it allows me to commission pieces not only for myself, but for many other people. So we did a quartet for the St. Lawrence String Quartet that Jim Matheson wrote, but it was a piece that they had wanted and that he had wanted, and we were able to be the fiscal conduit.
Okay.
And that's great. So here's an organization, it works. I knew Jim's work very well and the quartet's work, so it was something easy to say, yes, we're enthusiastic and excited about that. So people will come to me with ideas, and of course I have lots of ideas of people I hear.
So even the pieces that come out of this that fall under your hands first, you're premiering
sure.
a piece, you're more than happy if that piece is taken up by another pianist. And all.
Oh, it makes me, that's the very best thing, because you want a piece to have a life after you commission it and to be played by lots of people. It doesn't make sense that a piece just gets one performance. The more people that play something I commission, the better.
Yeah.
Better for the composer and hopefully better for everybody.
Sure, the composer always is hoping for that.
Sure.
Second, third, fourth,
sure.
Exponential more performances. Thank you.
Turning once again to my guest Bruce Levingston's highly acclaimed recording on Sono Luminous called Heavy Sleep, which includes works by Bach as well as transcriptions for piano of his works by noted composers and pianists, here is the title track, a work by American composer-pianist Timo Andres, a work commissioned for my guest and commissioned by his Premier Commission Inc., based or derived by the composer from a poem by the Swedish poet Tomas Tranströmer called Heavy Sleep. Thank you.
You mentioned how your recordings have a number of composers. It doesn't mean you have shunned the single composer. Talk about Foglass and your relationship with his music and him.
So I knew about Philip Glass's music for years, and I was following what he did with great operas and even some of the piano music I knew, but not all. But then I was about to play a concert, in fact, at Rockefeller University. It was, they have that wonderful series at Caspery Hall. And I had first learned about a painter named Chuck Close, in fact, through Mr. Rockefeller. And it was a work of Philip Glass. And he'd taken this same image of Glass that he'd taken in the 1960s with a photograph and turned it into all kinds of prints and paintings. And so Mr. Rockefeller bought one and called me to see it, and I said, well, that's Philip Glass, and he said, this is Chuck Close. And so we taught each other a little bit about these artists, but then he eventually gave that to the university, and I was about to play this concert, in fact, of portraits by composers. So it was Robert Schumann's The Kreisleriana was on that program, and Liszt, Valerie Doberman, and some such things. And so as I was standing out about to go on, I kept looking at that portrait. I thought, wouldn't it be great if Philip Glass wrote a musical portrait of Chuck Close? I knew they were friends, and Chuck Close, of course, one of the greatest painters of our day. And the fact that they were friends in much the way that Chopin and Delacroix had been friends, and Delacroix had painted Chopin. So all these kind of historical parallels came to mind. And this was just in a flash. And I went on, played the program, and then, you know, a few months passed, and then one of my friends was getting an award at the Academy of Arts and Letters, and he said, oh, you should come. And I'm thinking, maybe, I don't know. And so I decided I'd go, and lo and behold, there's Philip Glass, who I'd never met, and Chuck Close. And George Plimpton was a great friend, and we had performed together. We did a program at Carnegie Hall, and Eric Satie's Spori Divertissement, and just knew each other well, and I'd always try my programs out at his house. Anyway, he turns around and introduces me to both of them, and after I shook Chuck's hand, I was talking to Glass, and I said, listen, it's an odd idea, but, you know, I just want to say I saw this portrait of you by Chuck, and I wondered, of course, told him my idea, and I could really see him light up, and he said, well, I'll do it if you'll play it. And so I said, okay. And he immediately gave me his...
That wasn't a long thought process for you.
Amazing.
To go to okay.
Well, everybody said he'll never do this. But he gave me his emails and phone numbers, and I followed up. And people said, oh, he's writing, you know, scores for films and great works. This, it may be in 10 years. And 6 months later, I had the piece. And so that began this relationship. I went up to his home and played it a few times. And then eventually we performed together. I think the year after I played it at the Portrait of Chuck Close at Lincoln Center, we played a duo together. And we did the finale of Einstein on the Beach with a group, Colin Jacobson, a great friend, a great violinist, and Alisa Bialava, the fantastic, brilliant composer and beautiful singer. And Michael Cunningham and Ethan Hawke was on that program. And so we all did this together. And then I came to know Philip better. Also, I learned the terrifying sides because he was backstage rewriting my part because it had not been written for beforehand. So he said, oh, you can do this. And I was thinking, my God, the critic of the New York Times is out front and I'm about to go play something live that I've never rehearsed ever. And it's with Philip Glass. And he, during the performance, would say, okay, here comes that part. And while we were sitting on stage in front of everybody, and so it's coming, and get ready. And I would play it, and it was terrifying and hilarious.
That's a great story. I was going to bring up how you have worked across the arts lines often. You obviously enjoy doing it with artists and playwrights and poets,
sure,
and actors. But this story starts from there. It starts from the interdisciplinary, end up someplace where you probably didn't dream you would have ended up.
No. But, it seems that so many of the great artists, not just in music, but in theater and painting, think about other arts.
Right.
And, Whistler had a series called Nocturnes. In the period of the Ballet Russe, all of these musicians and writers, Jean Cocteau, was working with Picasso and Satie on Parade.
Right.
It's amazing. And then Cubism comes up, and Picasso makes these wild Cubist costumes. And I think that if you're a creative person, there are no boundaries. You just think of the inspiration and how can I realize this idea, and is it, if it's with paint or sound or your feet, it's whatever you do it.
Right.
Music for my guests' 2-CD set devoted to the music of Philip Glass, called Dreaming Awake, containing performances of 10 of Glass's piano etudes, his Metamorphosis No. 2, Dreaming Awake, and Wichita Vortex Sutra with actor Ethan Hawke. Here are two movements from the soundtrack Glass composed for the film The Illusionist. These movements are titled The Orange Tree and The Locket, performed by Bruce Levingston.
Thank you. you're a good one to ask this. Pianists, more than any other performer, musician, just have, you know, this tonnage of repertoire. If you had to maybe instruct a younger pianist, why should a pianist care about seek out, discover, commission, practice, perform new music when they wouldn't need to on paper? They wouldn't need to. Why should they be caught up in the newest music for this instrument?
I do think that whether you're a pianist or a violinist or whatever, thinking about music as something that is being written about right now in your own lifetime helps you understand the works of the past. It helps you think of a Beethoven or Brahms or Schubert as these real people and understanding what they were like. You know, as I came to work with so many composers, but really as I came to work with the best that I could, I came to see that they were also some of the biggest people in the spiritual sense, that they were more flexible about changing things. It's when somebody is insecure that they might fret over, no, it's this, this, or this. But some of the very greatest have said, oh, does this work for you? So you could rearrange this, or you could rearrange that movement. And then you hear of Beethoven telling, I believe it's Fernando Ries in England, he wanted to change the second and third movement around in the Hammerklavier, and Beethoven said, yes. Yeah. And it showed a kind of confidence in who he was as an artist, that he could do that. And so I think somehow that's one thing, learning about, even if you're not interested in new music, by thinking about that Beethoven was a living composer at one time and a living human being with ups and downs, and not just what you read in a book, but really what it's like, the day-to-day life was like. I think at some level it does help you. I can't explain what it is if you're playing, you know, maybe it's Opus 31, number 2, or Opus 109. This is a great, all these late sonatas are great, 109, 110, 111. But there are things in there, you can't say what it is. It comes to the story of Mendelssohn being asked, why didn't you put words with your songs without words? They're such beautiful piano pieces. And someone asked him, was it that the music was not specific enough? And he said, no, on the contrary, the music was too specific.
Right.
But these pieces, they have everything about human life in them. And so I think when you encounter a living, breathing composer, even briefly, it reminds you to look behind the ink.
Right.
And find out what's really going on. And maybe it informs you a little bit. I think knowing that Schubert was, when you hear those pieces from 1827 and 1828, you know that he was about to die. You're informed a little bit about why there's this veiled sadness there in those works.
Well, you just made me think that you've been fortunate enough to meet many of these composers, got to know them. Obviously, you walk up to Glass and ask him to write a piece. He says yes, because he stirs imagination, his muse. Other pianists may not have those connections. I mean, would you encourage pianists not only to play new music, but, I mean, with social media, with internet, and with, I mean, communication is so easy, to try to reach out?
I've had people reach out to me, young pianists or instrumentalists, that say, I want something new. Could I play this piece you played? And they're probably a little nervous about, am I going to get rejected? Will the person say no? And I have reached out to composers that you're taking a risk, of course, that the person says, no, I don't want to write this, or I'm too busy, or it's this or that. I think you have to take a risk and try to, I mean, Glass could have said no.
Right.
He just could have said no, or, you know, never gotten back to me. But one has got to try, and I think that's it. There are people who think it's, oh, you know, be fearless. Well, actually, I have, like everybody, plenty of fears. You know, you go out, it's an awesome thing to go out and play some of these things. I never go out without a little bit of the flutter. Will I meet the occasion? Will I do justice to the piece? It's not just that you play the piece, but that you really right. play the piece well, and you do your best. But still, this is the anxiety. But if you just never do it, then you never do it. And you've got to ask. And another aspect, too, of knowing these people and knowing other arts, it changes the way you think about, for me, it changes the way I think about the sound. So that it's not just piano sound, a one-dimensional approach. That if you're playing Schubert and you know his songs, you know that when he does a certain modulation, it can mean something. Or if you have seen a lot of art, you can think, my God, this piece of Debussy, I heard when I looked at Monet or Seurat, I heard those colors mm-hmm. in the paint. And it affects how you play.
Yeah.
It can affect how you pedal. All those shades that a I mean, I think about color a lot.
It's a refreshing approach that you take. Instrument. A little bit about, just about you. You're from Mississippi.
Wow. Whatever do you mean?
Yeah.
With my southern accent, yes.
But
I'm a southerner.
And it's not that great musicians, great classical musicians haven't come from the deep south, but you still
have a home there.
Home there, teach there.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about why and about the state, because many people listening to this might not know much about it.
Yeah, okay. So I'm, for years, only lived in New York, and now I divide my time between New York and Mississippi. I always kept kind of a foot back in my home state, loved playing there, loved so many aspects of this place. It's a complicated place. The Old South is complicated, and the New South is complicated. And, you know, Faulkner wrestled with it, and many other great minds and artists. It's no easy place to explain. But there's something very beautiful about my state and the people in my state. And I feel a little bit about Mississippi the way Mendelssohn did about his Songs Without Words. That it's so specific I almost can't explain it. I think the best explanation is that I'm there. Again, it's a little bit like what we talk about approaching composers. It's not without some bit of trepidation that I went to spend time back. I thought, well, first of all, will people want me back there? I mean, I do something that's very much out of the mainstream in many respects, playing not only classical music, but often new music. And I found that people there, it's just as I had when I grew up, just love creative people. It's one thing about our state. That's why we've produced so many artists. Yeah. You know, the list of musicians is unbelievable that come out of the state. And I didn't come from just anywhere in the state, but the Mississippi Delta. And Eudora Welty, of course, wrote about it. And I was born in the same hometown as Walker Percy, who wrote The Moviegoer, and the Percy family is a fantastic literary family. Hodding Carter's family was there. And my own family had a great passion and love for music and art. My brother's a brilliant painter. My mother painted and played the piano. My father played the piano and the clarinet. They weren't professionals, but it was a real passion for them. And I associated that, too, with Mississippi. Hmm. And I grew up also playing in lots of the churches, all kinds of music, which was great. It gave me a kind of background in learning how to, first of all, improvise, and like which you have to do sometimes when you play live. And then it's a place, it's my home.
Right.
And so anyway, the University of Mississippi reached out to me, and I have a chair there. I teach a course in art in the Republic. I don't teach piano, but just trying to have students think about what art means in our society and what society's influence is on art.
Yeah.
And so that's what it's about.
You mentioned the trepidation, your thoughts of, if I go back down there, will there be an audience? And
not just will there be an audience, but will they be interested in what I do as a musician?
But you meant it must have had enough faith deep down that it was going to happen. I mean,
I think part of it, too, is getting out there and playing. Morgan Freeman lives there, a wonderful actor and friend that I admire very much. He asked me to do something in his hometown, and I played for all the school children there. And it was really a great, great experience. I've done it now many times in other towns, to just play for children and, you know, not make it some kind of pedantic lecture on classical music, but just that people see something live happening, mm-hmm. and someone who came from their state who went out and did something that he or she wanted to do. And I think that that's important to do.
Back one last time to my guest's sonoluminous disc called Heavy Sleep. Music of the composer Mohammed Fairuz, who was one of the great 20th century composer Giorgi Ligeti's last pupils, a work titled as a prayer in memory of Ligeti called El Male Rakamim, God Full of Mercy. We'll hear Bruce Levingston perform the third movement, a full-on dance of death called I Who Brought Corpses from the Mountains.
think anyone listening to this would know that yours is not a restful mind when it comes to it. So what's up? What could you tease us with that's ahead in the next months?
So just last week, I made a new CD that will come out this fall. I made this for Sonar Luminous, a piece that David Bruce, the great British composer, wrote for me. And it's called In the Shadow of the Blackbird, and it's inspired by Schumann's music. He said it was inspired by a recording of the Kreisleriana that I made. But he takes it to this fantastic place where, you know, in the great codas of Schumann, you have a kind of disintegration of the music and a distilling down. And so I'd already recorded Kreisleriana, so I thought, well, I'm going to put two pieces where this happens. And there's another piece on there called Windows, which I told you about, that Jim Matheson wrote, inspired by Chagall's Windows. Chagall did these, in fact, for the Rockefeller family, and they depict different biblical scenes. And so this idea of something that is depicted, I thought of Schumann's Kinderszenen, mm-hmm. which is a fantastic piece. I had played some of the pieces, but when I really sat down to study the whole suite, it's an immensely deep, special work. And of course, in the very last movement, the poet speaks. This is what he does. He breaks everything down. There's a slight allusion to this piece or that you will sometimes see in codas. But it's just an utter simplicity that breaks your heart. And then there's another piece that I thought of that with the beautiful coda, the arabesque. So that's on that program. And then that will lead into the beautiful Windows piece that Jim Matheson wrote. And so that's coming out. And then in a few months, I'll record some of the pieces that I'm doing at Carnegie Hall in 2018 about being a citizen. And on that will be two works that I've commissioned for the Bicentennial of Mississippi, and specifically the opening of the Civil Rights Museum in Mississippi, which is, for me, a very important event.
Yeah.
You know, we've had great and difficult moments occur there that I think changed our country's history and certainly our state's history. And this is a moment that, you know, for our state to really officially acknowledge the suffering and difficulties that people have had, it's important. And it will hopefully teach future generations of all races what happened and hopefully how we can do more to treat each other well.
I said at the top, whether somebody's going to see you live or when the recording shows up in the mail, you're always an artist who says, oh, let's see what this is. I mean, there's an interest. There's a dynamic nature of what you do that gets people to draw into where you're going next and what you're going to do next. So I wish you success with all that.
Thank you.
I close on my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which simply says, if you could chat like we've been doing with one person from the past you never had a chance to. When I ask that, the first name that pops into your head, you get swamped usually if you think about it.
If I could ask what, though?
Anything. Would you just talk with them?
Or talk with any person from the past?
From the past, yeah. The first name that pops in.
Would that be an artist?
Could be anybody. I've had everybody from Jesus Christ to Groucho Marx and everybody in between.
Oh, I see. Yeah. All right.
But usually it's a composer, but... Yeah. Bach is the number one runaway answer. But.
Of course. You know, the composer I really think that I would like to have met is Beethoven.
Okay.
I have an idea. We know something of what it would be like because we have some records of what he was like. But somehow to be close, I don't think I'd even have to hear him speak. When you look at someone's face in the visage, inside their eyes, to encounter that, because... Again, I can't say what it is, but there's just everything in his music.
Mm-hmm.
And that he had such ferocity, but also such tenderness and humor and gentleness. And I think just to be in the presence of that being that could harness that. And also he had something else. He cared. I know he was probably hard on people around him, but he so obviously cared for humanity,
right,
and for freedom. And freedom is everything.
Yeah, I mean, what we know of him, sometimes the man from the stories doesn't match the scope of the music. It's like, it's very hard to...
Certain stories, but there are others. The tearing up of the dedication of the Eroica says it all to me. That in the end, for Beethoven, it was freedom. And the music really makes the statement. I sometimes place Beethoven in different eras and think, what would he do? Beethoven would not shrink under the pressure of dictatorship or difficult moments. He would stand up for what is right. And it's interesting, I've often said, Philip Glass has often said Schubert's his favorite composer. But there's a great Beethoven quality about Glass. Glass is a person, and even inside Glass is music. There's a character there that refuses to be silent and not stand up for what he believes is right. Right. And so, what a pleasure.
It would be a great trait for Beethoven to have that, to display that now in our current climate.
But Beethoven does. Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. His music is here now, and the spirit, his light that speaks for freedom, it still speaks. It speaks in me and to me, and I think to many others. And they may not even know it, but the fact that Beethoven existed inspired others, and it will help people find the way. I think that's the great thing about art. Yeah. And so in this period, obviously, it's not just in this country, around the world, we see a lot of difficult moments and where democracies are more fragile than ever. I come and think of Beethoven. Hmm.
Final question is a non-musical question, meaning everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy, but when you have to step away, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but need a little respite, what do you do?
I love my friends and love being with people, so that's one aspect of my life. It's just a joy, you know, to be with good friends. And I have wonderful nieces and family that, you know, so that's a marvelous part of my life. But I also love nature, and I have a terrific dog named Harper Lee, and we go for long walks. And I was just thinking yesterday about the pleasure I take in life just walking my dog, because you see nature all the time. You encounter unexpectedly people. I've met so many friends just walking my dogs. And that's a pleasure. And plus, you're doing something with another living being that's, I think, communing with animals is very special. Again, it's one of those things that you can't explain the language. It's just there. But I really love living beings, and I feel that we're just part of the tapestry of, you know, their world.
Bruce Livingston, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pianist Bruce Livingston. You can find out more about him at his website, brucelevingston.com, his Premier Commission at premiercommission.org, and his recordings are on the Sono Luminous label. Check them out at sonoluminous.com. You've heard my guest play Bach. He has not yet released recordings of Beethoven, so I'll leave you with him performing music by the other B from his recording titled Night Break, music of Liszt, Wolfgang Riem, Philip Glass, and Brahms. Here is the latter's Waltz in D minor, Opus 39, number 9, performed by my guest today, Bruce Livingston. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.